Environmentally sound for your mind. HRNradio.com.
Hi, everybody. Helping yourself to know how is why you're here with Dr. Greer, and you're listening to the Doctor on Call Hour at HealthyLife.net. Today we're featuring Pop Psych with Dr. Greer, where we chat with leading experts in the mental health and psychology field who are helping us understand more about how our minds tick. We bring you the most compelling research and practical guidance on relationships, mental health, and addiction. It's about understanding ourselves and others. Each month we feature editors, bloggers, authors, and therapists to share the latest in the world of human behavior. In today's episode, we'll be hearing from authors Kenya Issa and Arjuna Ardog. Joining me now is my first guest, Kenya Issa. She's a Berkeley, California native with 30-plus years working with children and families. She's the author of Sacred Girl. She's won awards for teaching and writing and is the recipient of the 2014 San Francisco Fashion Award for Best Makeup Artist. She became a registered yoga teacher in 2016, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Greer. I'm so excited to be here.
And we want to know, because you've been so inspiring in so much of the work that you've done, what was your inspiration for writing Sacred Girl? First of all, tell us about it, and what was your inspiration?
Sure. So Sacred Girl, so the book is called Sacred Girl, Spiritual Life Skills for Conscious Young Women.
Oh, my.
And it is really a guidebook or kind of a toolbox, so to speak, for young women. And I'm learning that a lot of people that are not young women are really into the book. And so that's been really kind of exciting and unexpected on this journey. And it's really kind of reaching into your own skills when things get really hard. So I was working with a group of girls at a residential rehab here in Northern California, and what I found that was that they were reaching for drugs and sex and all kinds of unhealthy, you know, coping things to help them cope with their traumas and their pain instead of looking within. And I was inspired by them to have a spirituality group, to start and to grow a spirituality group that then became pretty popular. And my kids all had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, so it was a very specialized group of girls. And I found myself at a loss, really, to be perfectly honest, as to how to help them. I felt like I wasn't helping them in the way that it on a deeper level. And so I started doing a lot of reading and research and looking for ways to help them, and I couldn't find it. And so I wrote it.
You know, it's so interesting. Terrific what you did. So your own personal experience and struggle really became the motivating force to push you forward to find answers that were not forthcoming. And it's always so interesting that as we have our struggles, our personal struggles in life, that they somehow carve a new road of destiny for us. I know from my own experience, like when my mother passed away many 20 years now, that it was such a devastating loss for me, and having had exposure to afterlife connection, to spirituality in this other dimension, that, you know, the last thing I thought I would ever wind up doing would be writing a book on afterlife connection and delving so much into it to find relief and sustenance and to become a driving force to helping others and teaching others how to comfort themselves and connect with loved ones who pass over. But it,
yeah.
The personal struggles, we suffer, and we really just try to make our way with resilience through, and yet they become the defining lines in the sand in our lives, don't they?
That is so, so true. And it's interesting, too, because as a young counselor at that time, you know, there's a lot of ego involved.
Right, right.
You know, so I was kind of like, wow, why am I not getting this? You know, like, what am I doing wrong, or how can I do this? And I think there was a part of it that was just like making it about myself and trying to be successful in working with the kids. And I had to take a look at that as well, you know, while I was, you know, doing this research and reading all these books and trying to figure out what I was missing. And it was really helpful to talk to adult women who had been through lots of trauma, who had who were referring me to books about you know, traumatic events and traumatic childhoods and drug use and all of these things, and spirituality and goddess worship and, you know, all of these things. And it really, really helped me to take a look at how I was kind of making this a circular effort to come back to me being a good counselor, when really my goal and my job was to help young women kind of grow up into adults and stay alive, you know, and not only that, but to, when they got to adulthood, to then not need me or need something like a spirituality group, because the spirituality and the strength and everything like that is within all of us. And in my personal opinion, women are the strongest creatures on the planet. And so I wanted to inspire them to be that for themselves.
It's really so admirable. And, you know, as you're saying, that you think because you're the counselor that you're supposed to have all the answers. And it's funny because as therapists, people think, well, you're a therapist, so you must know where everything in your life must just go smoothly and hunky-dory. But the truth of the matter is you can know the answers and know what's going to work for other people. But when you're dealing with your own emotional quandaries, you cannot sometimes see the forest for the trees, and you really do need to seek guidance, either finding it as you did by reaching outside yourself or reaching to other people. So let me ask you this, because we all hear the word spiritual, spirituality. What did that mean for you when you talk about, you know, Sacred Girl is about being on a spiritual journey? What is exactly a spiritual journey, and why is it so important to be on one?
So it's my opinion that it is extremely important, and to embark on a spiritual journey is to seek, you know. We grow and we change so much over time. I know I certainly have. I'm a very different person than I was, you know, when I was young, or when I was like in my early 20s or whatever. And I feel like that's especially true for girls. There are many expectations put upon us from toddlerhood, you know, and even as far as like roles, you know, we are given dolls, we start parenting our dolls in preparation for motherhood, we experience the way we're treated very differently from boys are treated, you know, very early on. I know that in my family, the difference between the way my boy cousins were treated and the expectations put upon them was vastly different from the way myself and my girl cousins were treated. And so I think that, you know, all children have to have guidance, but when we reach a point of awareness of ourselves and the world around us, we start a journey towards independence. And I think that a spiritual journey is not so much a journey of the mind, but it's a journey of the soul and the heart as well. And it's deeply personal. It's authentic. It's not about the role that we're brought up to play, you know, as women. We are so much more than those roles and expectations. And getting to know yourself on a spiritual level and allowing that connection to the universe, learning how to receive the gifts that the universe has for you is part of that journey, and it is crucial, and in my opinion, but it's crucial if you're going to be healthy and successful and seek out the right kinds of relationships. You know, that's another big one, is, you know, kind of the way you handle yourself on the inside and the way you handle your spiritual journey will then eke itself out into your relationship. So, yeah, it's important.
So let me ask you this. Would you say that spirituality resonates with being true to yourself, being in touch with yourself emotionally and respecting your feelings and then letting them guide some of your behaviors and choices, that having that connection with what you feel and what you want as well as what you think, is that sort of part of that spiritual journey?
It's definitely part of the spiritual journey, yes. I think that when we think of spirituality a lot, we're thinking about, when people say that word, we're trained to think God or higher power or whatever, and it could be that. For a lot of people, it is that, but for some people, it is not. And so then you've got, you know, how you feel supported by the universe, or if you feel supported by the universe, like the law of attraction. You know, if I put out a certain kind of energy, then that is going to come back to me. If I put out positive energy, or if I think of myself in a positive way, then that's going to come back to me, because I'm creating an aura of positivity and of love and of generosity. And so there, it's so multi-layered. So yes, everything that you said, and also, you know, having faith that you will be supported by your quote-unquote higher power, or just by the universe having your back, you know.
And so that's really such a critical feeling to have, because if you do have that sense of trusting in the universe and this larger sort of being, power, whatever it is that is divine to you personally, mm-hmm. it helps you feel safer. And
yeah.
So if you're dealing with fear and tension and anxiety, it helps you to feel safer that, you know, that somehow there's a greater force at work, and that you mm-hmm. can continue to strive and will be supported in your quest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You got it.
Thank you. So if you're a young girl, though, who's growing up with, you know, squabbling parents, just divorced parents, sibling issues, alcohol and/or drugs in the family, a lot of conflict and a lot of tension and anger and sense of danger, kind of pervasive, or never knowing when the shoe is going to drop, and no real sense of safety. How do you begin to take a spiritual journey? How do you guide them?
Well, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote the book was to not only help the girls themselves, but like you said, how do you guide them? Help other people, parents or counselors or psychotherapists or whatever, to help them help themselves. And these days, very different from when I was a young girl, there's also the social media aspect. And so what a lot of young girls are doing is they're going on Tumblr, Instagram, or wherever, and they're seeking support and acknowledgement, and oftentimes they're joining groups of people that are not necessarily healthy. You know, I'm feeling really depressed, so I'm going to join a group of depressed people, you know, or I'm anorexic. You know, there's a lot of pro-anorexia groups on Instagram, you know, so I that's the way I feel, so I'm going to talk to all these people that support that behavior. And that is, you know, social media can be helpful to people who feel really, really alone, but it can also add to the problems that you're having, you know.
Right.
There's a lot out there, more and more coming out about how it can be dangerous. And so, you know, when I talked about this whole spiritual journey and what it takes, the first thing I thought about was starting with self-care. And that is really crucial. And I don't mean self-care by someone else's standards, right? There's a lot expected of, from young people today. There's educational excellence, sports, whatever activities they're involved in. And there's even a book entitled The Overscheduled Child that really hits on the issue of when is enough enough. And while I agree that young people shouldn't just be sitting around doing nothing with their lives all the time, there has to be some sort of downtime and some time for them to just breathe and connect and feel connected again to that universal connection, right? And the whole idea of stillness and reflection is a really cool skill for girls to learn while they're young. You know, everything can't be about performing and achieving, because we have a lot of very burnt out, very young people out there. And that kind of performance burnout leads to stress, and that leads to poor school performance, and that can lead to greater problems like depression and, you know, the over-medication of our children.
You know?
And that's a major, as a social worker for 20 years, that was a serious personal pet peeve of mine, that the questions are often asked, what medication can we put them on? You know, our entire country is over-medicated. Many women are over-medicated and have been for decades, and we don't often ask, what is the spiritual deficit? Like, what's the real problem here? And that it was a huge issue in my work. And I had less than one third of my kids that were not on some sort of medication. I feel like it's time for people and young people from a very young age to identify their own needs and desires. And when they do that, they develop healthy boundaries, a strong sense of self, you know, and that's what they need to grow into healthy adults. And adults can use these tools as well, you know.
Absolutely. No question about it. So let me ask you this, because you're such a really, truly a busy entrepreneur. You're a wife and a mom. How do you juggle so many responsibilities without, you know, getting stressed and anxious yourself?
You know, that's an interesting question for today, because it's definitely a challenge. And so I'm going to, you know, I think a lot of people think that because I kind of wrote a book about this type of stuff, and I'm working on my next book right now, and, you know, I have a job and I'm doing work with other people. It's a lot. And then I homeschool my child.
Oh boy.
It's kind of a never ending thing. And I'm constantly talking to other people about managing the hamster wheel of life, you know, and what you can do. And to be perfectly honest, and you probably know this too, is sometimes it's easier to tell other people how to, you know, you should take it easier, or you should, you know, practice better self-care, and then over here I'm run down and frazzled, you know.
Right.
So it's challenging. It is really challenging, but I'm very, very committed to taking personal time for myself. Very committed. It's hard. It's really hard, but I try.
To putting the boundaries in place. So when you start working with some of the younger girls, well, we're going to put a boundary in place actually now. I'll ask you this question when we come back from break. But it's exactly along the lines of, where do you start teaching them how to put the most compelling boundaries in place in their lives that will enable them to gain confidence in themselves and in the universe that there is support for them. But we're putting a boundary in place. We're taking a break, so stay with us. Mm-hmm. We'll be back in a minute for more of Pop Psych with Dr. Greer at HealthyLife.net.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Pop Psych with Dr. Greer here at HealthyLife.net. My guest is author Kenya Iser. You can find more from her on Twitter at RubyEnvy, R-U-B-Y-E-N-V-Y, and her website, www.rubyenvywellness.com. So I was asking you before we went to break about boundaries. I mean, there are so many challenges that kids have, that young girls have, from when, where, and how to use social media and where to put the boundary in place, from, you know, when to be giving and extending yourself to help a friend because you care, or go home and do your homework. And just like you were saying, for yourself, and, you know, you've had years and years of experience, it's hard to say no. You know, particularly to helping people or to an opportunity to do something that can take you further down your spiritual road. How do you teach them boundaries? How do they start?
That is the million-dollar question, I think.
Well, I'm glad I asked it.
Yeah, because, I mean, again, like you said, I mean, you know, I have continued to struggle with this, especially since I'm a person that's in the helping field. And so, you know, you have friends, and they want to call you, and they want to vent about their problems for 2 hours.
Right.
And that is not an exaggeration. I literally have friends that will call and talk to me for 2 hours about their problems. And
wow.
So what I had to do, which was not necessarily comfortable, but I had to do this because this is what I'm teaching young girls, right? So
right.
I'm teaching other people how to do this, and I need to walk the walk.
Right. You got to practice and get your own emotional muscle in place.
Totally. And so, you know, sometimes you just have to not answer your phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is really hard for young people because they're glued to their phones, right? And, or, you know, you have to just ask yourself, is this going to be a healthy exchange for me? You know, is this going to contribute to my life, or do I need to just take a breather? And we are so, like I said, we're so kind of go, go, go and overscheduled, and then we overschedule ourselves, and then we have the ability to constantly be doing something and engaging something in something because of our telephones and our social media. So I think that balance is incredibly important, and that is a number one lesson is balance. And it is really hard to teach young girls, young people really, balance because you know, we are a very, very kind of go, go, go society, and ultimately it's just not healthy. It's not healthy for our bodies. You know, you've got all the endorphins and all of this stuff going on inside of your body based on what you do, you know, and what you engage in. And, you know, it's really important to be mindful of what your mind is doing so that you can be mindful of how your body is reacting to what's going on in your head. And so, it's really important to say no, to learn how to say no. That is one of the most important words in the English language, especially for women, because you know we are not trained to say no.
Right.
We are trained to say yes, yes, yes to everything.
Well, you know what I teach my patients oftentimes to say, yes, that sounds like a great idea. I'd love to do it. However, I'm not going to be able to do it now, or I can do it in another week. But see, also, in addition to not answering the phone, which I think is putting a limit in place for yourself, which is good, I also think it's important to put a limit in place with other people by way of saying, you know, getting on the phone and saying, look, I really want to hear what's happening. I'm concerned about you. I can talk for the next 20 minutes, and then I'm going to have to hang up. Or, I can't talk to you now, I can talk to you tomorrow. Or, if your friend is going on 2 hours all the time, to say, you know what, I love you dearly, maybe you want to go see somebody professionally who can really help you, because it's upsetting me to see you so distressed.
Sure, and so I do have one friend that I tried that with, and she has professional help, but she still wants to call me every time she breaks a nail, you know, every time something happens. And so what I then will say, I mean, what you're saying is certainly one way, and it depends on how many people are calling you also, because you can't tell 8
true
we can talk for 20 minutes.
Right, absolutely true.
I don't have that kind of time. And so...
You've got a roster going on.
I do. I've been in this business for a long time. But also, I love my friends just like everybody else. But I think one thing that I learned is that if I say no to you, then that gives you an opportunity to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that gives you an opportunity to figure it out yourself, because you can.
Mm-hmm.
You can figure it out yourself. You are totally have power. You're totally in power to handle things better than you think you can. We are greater than we think.
Right. Yes, I agree with you 100%. I think the slippery slope is for your friend to not feel abandoned or left alone, that because you think they can take care of themselves, that therefore they can, if they don't think they can and think that they need your help. So it's being able to, to put that limit in place to say, yeah, I'd love to talk to you, but I can't, to not answer the phone, as you're saying, to let them know, here's when you can call me, so that you structure it for yourself. Because otherwise, when you're somebody like yourself who's a resource and caring and concerned and empathic and filled with knowledge and a skill set, you can wind up, being everybody's therapist and mom. And,
it's great to support each other. I'm always saying that there's a woman, I don't know if she's a writer or not, but I took this quote a long time ago. Her name is Nina Shaw. And she said, if you want to be an empowered woman, empower other women. And I definitely think that we need to support each other. But I can't support you if I have an empty cup. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, if I have been drained all day by not just all my other friends who are calling me, and then I have a best friend who has, my best friend has cancer.
Oh.
I'm always, with her and all of these other things. And then I've got, a husband and a child and other people pulling at me from a lot of directions. If I have an empty cup, I can't help anybody. And so if I'm in a moment where I'm filling my own cup and you happen to call me with some drama that I already know you, so I know that this is just that you are just having a drama moment, if it's something more serious, then I'll respond to that, or if it's something that if I really, really know you and I know what's going on, I'll determine, is this just some everyday drama or is this something really serious, because I don't think we should abandon each other. Because I think that women need each other now more than ever in these times. And so sticking together is really important.
Well, it's wonderful advice. It's very insightful. And I want to thank you for such an insightful conversation on your experiences and how they led to your book that is out there for other people to use as a resource and to get help. Listeners, be sure to follow Kenya on Twitter at Ruby Envy and her website, www.rubyenviswellness.com. Thank you, Kenya, for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. When we come back, author Arjuna Arda will be joining us. Stay with us, back in a minute.
All positive natural health programs on hrnradio.com.
Welcome back to the Pop Psych with Dr. Greer Show here at healthylife.net. My next guest is Arjuna Arda. Arjuna is a best-selling writer, public speaker, and executive coach who's trained more than 2,000 coaches over the last 25 years. He's the author of 9 books, including the 2005 number one national bestseller, The Translucent Revolution. His latest book, Radical Brilliance, is the anatomy of how and why people have original ideas which change the world. He's been a speaker at conferences all over the world, including at Google and the United Nations. And it's a pleasure to have you here on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. It's definitely intriguing to talk about the very different kinds of subjective experience and brain activity, which your book describes, all these different cycles that will actually make somebody more innovative and original. So talk to us about that, because it's always a question of where does the creative idea come from? I know with a lot of artistic people, they go to sleep, they dream a song, they dream a movie, but a lot of people don't have these extraordinarily creative dreams. Where do the innovative, creative ideas come from, the originality?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Thank you.
I think that the hypothesis, I suppose, that the book suggests is that there are actually two kinds of thought, all thoughts look similar because they all lead to action and they all lead to speech. But actually, we could say there are two different kinds of thought. One is a thought that is basically a repetition of something we've heard before, okay? And that's the most common kind of thought, that you, something, like, for example, when you, you know, when you're on the subway or whatever and you hear a song in your head.
Right.
That's not a new song you're hearing. You're hearing a regurgitation of a song that you've heard previously.
Right.
And almost all thoughts are like that. They're repetitions of things we've heard before. But occasionally, something comes into consciousness which is not a repetition of something that's previous. It's actually an original, innovative thought. And actually, I've studied this a lot. When the book was published, I had interviewed 420 people who I considered to be original and brilliant. Now it's 450. And pretty much everybody says the same thing. But these kind of original thoughts that are truly innovative, you don't really do them. You receive them. You know, you are in a disposition of openness, of receptivity, and they happen to you. And, you know, there's so much testimony to this in every discipline. For example, Albert Einstein was laying in the bathtub, relaxing, when the general theory of relativity clarified itself to him. Now, of course, Albert Einstein needed all those years of knowledge about theoretical physics and astronomy to be the right kind of mind to receive that. But it's the same with great musicians. It's the same with everything. And this is so relevant today, Jane, because of the times in which we live. You know, I went to a conference just a few weeks ago where Al Gore was speaking about climate change, and also Peter Diamandis was speaking, the founder of the X Prize. And they both said the same thing, which is, we have all of these problems that face us. You know, there's environmental problems, there's pollution problems, there's financial inequality problems, there's the financial system. I mean, you could go on all day just listing unsolved problems. But what the point that both Al Gore and Pete Diamandis made was that we have solutions to most of these things. We don't have a lack of solutions. We've got tons of solutions. What we don't have is the attitude to implement them. You know, so we've got an attitude problem, not a resource problem. So actually, more than ever today, what the world needs is more and more people with a disposition of contribution. If we could actually shift the way that we operate in our minds to collaborating together, working together to implement new technology, we would not have the kind of earth that we have. It's an attitude problem that we have, and that requires us to shift more into thinking in original ways.
In truth, if we are anxious and, you know, worried and stressed, won't that disrupt creativity or originality?
Absolutely. You know, but anxiety and stress, as you mentioned, I would say those are symptoms. You know, those are symptoms, not causes.
Mm-hmm.
And anxiety and stress, but equally craving, you know, craving, greed, desire, these are all symptoms of a contracted way of experiencing life. A contracted way means essentially me first, you know, me. I need more for me. And of course, everybody wants to feel good, you know. everybody wants a good life. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you should become some sort of martyr, you know, or give up good things in life. But actually, people who enjoy life the most are not people whose lives are primarily dedicated to me. People who report incredible levels of fulfillment, which is what my book is about, Radical Brilliance, I went to look for people, not who were necessarily accomplished a lot. I just sought out people who display extraordinary levels of fulfillment. People who live in constant gratitude, constant humor, people whose lives are just magical. And I went to look for what is the common denominator. You know, what
fascinating.
I was looking to see what is it that makes life amazing? What is it that causes people to have good health and lots of energy and have great relationships all the way late into life? And it's not thinking about yourself. This is the interesting thing, that this kind of extraordinary level of fulfillment, it is the reward that you get from a life of contribution. When you really dedicate your days to solving problems that are much bigger than you, the spontaneous result is everything works well. And I've investigated this so thoroughly with so many people now, I'm convinced, you know, that we've got things upside down a lot of the time.
Hold on to that note, the upside down note, because we're going to be right side up and go right to commercial and take a break here at the Pop Psych with Dr. Greer. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute at HealthyLife.net.
Podcast to help you reach your positive potential. HRNradio.com.
Welcome back to Pop Psych with Dr. Greer here at HealthyLife.net. My guest is author Arjuna Arda. You can find more from him on his website, www.radicalbrilliance.com. We were talking during the break about, you know, where does creativity, where do these original thoughts come from? And from my own experience and from others that I've worked with, I was saying that a lot of times it's when you're sleeping and it's a little disruptive, you wake up, or it's, you know, in sort of inopportune moments. And Arjun, you were saying there were ways to really clear your mind for originality and also capture it. So tell us about that.
Yeah, great. So the book describes what we call the brilliance cycle, which is four different quadrants of subjective experience, but also of brain activity. And so sleep is a little, relying upon sleep is pretty touch and go. I mean, that might work, but Salvador Dali relied on sleep and taking naps and things, but that's not really a very reliable method to rely upon what comes with sleep. So there is a much more reliable way that relies upon what similar things that are happening in sleep. When you go to sleep, you're basically, at least part of the night, you're entering into dreamless sleep, which is characterized by deep level delta, you know, brainwave activity. So it means basically you're getting contentless consciousness, as far as we know it, or at least very slow waves of brain activity. So what we want to be able to do is generate that kind of emptiness, but at the same time as being conscious. So the book advocates, well, as well as these four quadrants, the book advocates for a lifestyle, which has been tried and tested and really, really works well for people, which is to wake up a little earlier in the morning. We recommend in the book to wake up 1 hour before the dawn. That's quite a significant time because there's actually stuff happens at the dawn. When the light is first coming up, you see all the animals wake up. There's a boost of energy. So 1 hour before the dawn, you wake up and you basically just go and sit with your eyes closed. You don't have to call it meditation, which makes it a bit daunting. You just simply sit with your eyes closed. I actually wear a sleep mask, you know, so that your eyes can be open or closed, doesn't matter. And if you simply observe, you just sit there and just observe what's going on, you're going to enter very quickly back into that kind of emptiness that you have in the night. But now it's accompanied by alpha 2. So you've got delta brainwaves and alpha 2 at the same time. What that means is there's a kind of an emptiness accompanied by alertness, and you become extremely aware of these sensations in the body, very aware of any little thought forms that are happening. In that kind of stillness that happens before the dawn, you can become sensitive to these little sprouts of creativity that are actually happening naturally within this unified state of consciousness. And this is not very mystical stuff. It happens if you just try it. If you get the book, just read the instructions and try it. It works really quickly. And you start to notice these little impulses of fresh creativity as pleasure, right? It's a little bit like sexual arousal, but it's happening anywhere in the body, you know? So I mean, everyone knows it's a good kind of reference point. Everyone knows what it's like to get a little bit horny. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine having that kind of arousal, but in your left shoulder or in your left elbow or something, you know. So you've got this, you've got these little pockets of pleasure that you notice that start happening in the body, and if you just breathe into them and they expand, we have a method in the book called Tickle and Capture, which is where you can notice this kind of energy building, and then you capture it, for example, by writing very quickly, or by, it could be by drawing. Sometimes, even if you're not by profession an artist, putting something into drawing can be a quicker way to capture it. So we have ways of capturing it, and then, but that's not the end of the process. It's just that to actually create brilliance, now that has to be translated into things that can be implemented. And the book explains four very different quadrants which you can move through every day, you can move through in a bigger way every week, you can move through in an even bigger way throughout the year. There are these quadrants of different, four very different styles of subjective experience, which is accompanied by a very different kind of brain activity, which allows you to become innovative, which means your life becomes about contribution to something much bigger than yourself. And the fantastic payoff for that, even though it's not why we do it, is it leads to completely incomparable levels of fulfillment, of feeling good about yourself, of feeling healthy, of knowing you're a good person, making a difference, your relationships get better, you make more money. Everything goes better when your life becomes dedicated to something bigger than yourself.
So it really sounds like a very viable, workable approach and strategy. My question, though, because I'm playing devil's advocate for people who are listening and want to start something. I mean, I know people that want to exercise for their health and are already up at the crack of dawn to get their kids to bed or to get to work and commute an hour to get there or to get in early because they have to, you know, finish working a project for a presentation or what have you. How do you encourage or motivate people to get up so early, to not have that extra hour of sleep when they're putting their kids down and or, you know, coming in and going to bed so late? I can already hear people going, it sounds easy but impossible.
Well, you know, it's this does require a dedication, you know, it may require shifting things around a bit. You know, you don't necessarily have to get less sleep. You just adjust your time clock to go to bed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in bed, you know, before 9 every night. And it's just a matter of priorities. You know, it's a matter of really deliberately stepping back a bit and thinking, what do you want to use your few decades of human life for? You know, and what is the most intelligent way to dedicate your life in the present times in which we live? And, I mean, many people, what you're describing is, you know, a lot of people talk to me about, when people talk to me about their lives, many people use words like crazy, oh, it's crazy, oh, it's
right.
Mad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And these words, crazy, mad, are actually synonyms for mental illness, right? The word crazy, it's a synonym for mental illness. We don't want our lives to be synonyms for mental illness. We want our, I mean, my life is not crazy. My life's sane. My life is not mad. It's balanced and deliberate and carefully thought out. And the things that I do in each part of the day are exactly what I believe to be the best thing to do. And I encourage other people to live the same way. Don't get wrapped up in some, you know, crazy lemming race of sort of just mad activity. It's good to step back a little bit and deliberately, consciously create a life which is the best use of this time on the planet. So if people feel like, oh, my life's out of control and I've got all this stuff, well, then change it. You know, make some choices to change it so that you're living a life that is really a good example for those children that you're talking about.
Great advice. Absolutely great advice. Now, you've written a chapter about innovation, the creative process, and it has a chapter about sex. Does that connect to what you were talking about before, tapping into the pleasure ripples in one's body when you access creative energy?
Yeah, well, I mean, when we spoke about it a few minutes ago, we used it as an analogy, you know, as a parallel, but
mm-hmm.
It can also be used directly. Because, you know, we got a lot of taboos around sex because, you know, our society evolved out of Puritanism and they had a problem with sex. But sex is basically just a way of It's a very convenient way to generate massive amounts more energy in the body, you know? And there's nothing wrong with it, you know? I mean, sex is a natural thing. Every mammal on the planet has sexual arousal. It's completely a natural thing. There's no need to make some unnecessary problem out of it. So basically, the book describes ways that we can take the sexual energy and cultivate it in very particular ways so that it actually transforms into. And I won't go more into that now because it's quite detailed. But the book, you know, if anybody can get around the unnecessary taboos around sex, you'll see that sexual energy is a really great way to it's a great segue into creating more energy and channeling it in useful ways.
Terrific. Well, Arjuna, I want to thank you for such a stimulating and fascinating conversation on your work and
thank
book
you.
And for being here. Thank you. And listeners, you can find more from Arjuna on his website, www.radicalbrilliance.com. And that is it for today. Join me next week for a new episode of Shrink Wrap On Call. My guest will be author Kevin Murphy and single mom expert Carrie Zane. Stay in touch with me off the air at my Facebook page and on Twitter at Dr. Jane Greer. And thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, you can always get what you want when you're in the know.